Welcome to Monday Mornings with Matt and Kevin, hosted by the Catholic Family Podcast. These two will debate real-life issues all from a Catholic perspective every Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern. Sit back, relax, grab your cup of coffee, and enjoy the show. Here are your hosts, Matt and Kevin.
A very happy Monday morning to everybody out there, and a happy second day of Advent. So we might have fewer listeners. I understand that. A lot of people giving up social media, giving up YouTube for Advent. I definitely appreciate that. But we're still going to do our best to provide shows, to provide good content for those who are still listening to YouTube or Podbean or wherever you might be listening to this show. So stick with us here. And we got some pretty interesting topics. Matt, unfortunately, could not show up today. Matt is ill. At least he says he's ill. He might just be sick of talking to me. I'm not sure. Matt, you better let me know in the comments if you're actually sick or if you just don't want to talk to me. I know he feels pretty bad because he had a terrible opinion about Thanksgiving meals being worthless. So maybe he's kind of hiding a little bit after that bad opinion. Definitely would make sense. But if he's actually sick, then everyone say a prayer for Matt that he gets better and that he's back here next week. But I'm joined by my dad. We're going to talk today about a few things. We have a couple topics that I find very interesting. One is that Francis Bergoglio comes out and says that the church, the Novus Ordo Church, of course, is too masculine, which is pretty incredible. And also we're going to talk a bit about a little bit of a clip that I saw from Dave Ramsey, who is a financial talking head. Let's say that. I just saw it on Facebook, and it's pretty much having to do with a young couple who is almost $1 million in debt. And so we're going to talk with my dad about kind of the issue with debt and, you know, how we've gotten there, you know, kind of looking at it from the economical sense from the top down, but also how do you get there societally? How do you get it to be a 30-year-old and be $1 million in debt? Pretty hard to imagine. But we also first want to mention, because dad has spent, I don't know how many hours. I don't think he could even count how many. Countless hours. Mom probably could. Mom probably could count how many countless hours that you have spent on the Indefectible episode that we just published yesterday on the Catholic Family Podcast. It's something that I've watched, of course, a couple times now. I absolutely love it. And I guess, Dad, I don't know. I'll open it up to you. We're going to chat about that for a minute. I mean, right. What was that experience like, I suppose, making this?
Oh, it's phenomenal. And first of all, I got to give some big props to the way the whole thing originated was with Father Carlos Borja here in Omaha, who has put together a registry of he's got a webpage now, Modern Ordinary, where he's got all of these photos of churches. And I think that what inspired the whole thing, I think you were actually inspired first with it in that you see all these photos and you realize these are all our churches, you know, and I think it's phenomenal to actually see how robust, how big the real church. You get away from the Novus Ordo and, you know, like at St. Athanasius said, they have the churches, we have the faith, but you know what? We've got some pretty nice churches too. So it was a phenomenal experience to have all of those photos that we got to kind of put out there and honor and glorify. But it's been, I think, several months in the making, and it's just lots and lots of hours, tedious and like we were saying before the show, you're trying to evoke emotion with this type of a thing, and you know, when I was in the early phases of putting it together, you know, I put together a couple of these scenes, like the one with the original priests, and you got Gabriel's oboe in the background, and I'm just crying putting this together. But by the time it's actually, you know, you've gone through and the whole thing, and you're doing the sound mixing, and you're doing the transitions, and you're making sure you're depixelated all your photos, and you go through the mechanics of it, you kind of lose that emotion. So I put it out, you know, we actually published it yesterday, and by the time it goes out, I mean, I kind of understand now why there are directors and actors who they'll do movies and then they don't even want to ever, they never watch the movie that they put out, just because, sure. I think that it starts to take on a little bit different meaning to you than it does to everybody else. So I really hope that it's an inspiration to people and to understand that we've gone through some hard times as a movement, but the future is just incredibly bright, and the present's incredibly bright.
No, absolutely. And it is, I mean, something I can tell you, I've watched it a couple times now, and it definitely has struck me emotionally. I mean, even the end part, you know, you get the last, I don't know, 10 minutes, and you get the sermon with Bishop Dolan giving this beautiful sermon, yeah. And you get the churches, and you got Spem and Allium in the background. It's just, oh, it gets me every time, but it's a great video. And I think that it's one of those things that I know we talked about many times, that the time that goes into these things cannot be underestimated. I mean, the Glorious Heritage cartoons is another one that I know.
Right.
These guys offer these things for free, and they spend 100 hours making one cartoon. It's just ridiculous stuff. And I think we need to appreciate that more. And it's the same with you. And it's one of these things that you and I are talking about before the show. We're like, hey, you know, this is episode 4, but you know, we're kind of determining now, it's like, where do we want to go with this? What do we want to do? We want to tell stories about the original quote unquote, the nine, you know, the nine who left,
right.
You know, Archbishop Lefebvre. You know, we want to talk about, you know, these other independent churches. We want to talk about, you know, the IMBC here in Europe. We want to tell mm-hmm. these stories, but guys, I know you don't want to hear this, but we actually do need money for that. We're not in this. I know some people, maybe his name, first name begins with S, last name begins with H, thinks that we're just in it to have nice vacations in Italy. But I can guarantee you that's not going to happen because, we don't make that much money, but
yeah,
we do. I mean, so look at it this way. If we want to have a video talking about the nine, then we're going to want to go and talk to people who know about the nine, right? And we, of course, we can do it online, but it's much better in person. If anyone's seen the video with Bishop Piverunas, I think it's much better than anything we've done over the internet. There's just something different about it. It looks different. It feels different. There's a different, you know, I don't know, atmosphere. And so we want to do these things in person. And then, yeah, you know, we have our own bills and families and stuff to pay for. So we can use your help. I know, again, you don't have to. Nobody has to. Mr. SH, no worries. We're not going to get rich off of this. But please support us on Patreon, PayPal. That money will go directly into plane tickets or gasoline to driving to St. Gertrude the Great to do these interviews and stuff. So keep that in mind. This is not sending me to Italy for vacation, guys. This is sending people to go and do interviews, hopefully around the world. And I think we have grand dreams, I think, Dad, right? Our dreams are very big, but we need a little help.
Right. Right. Well, and I think one of the other ones in this next wave that just fascinated me with as we put this together, I had no idea, I don't think, until I got into this video, and you'll see it out there, just how robust and big the church is in Mexico. It's like, holy cow, these churches in Mexico are amazing. The Trento gorgeous. Institute, the gorgeous churches. And I think that you've got Father Sáenz Iriaga that started the whole thing, who was kind of a former Cristeros and has brought that. I think in some cases in Mexico, they just never turned over the churches to the Novus Ordo. Wouldn't you love to hear those stories? I mean, and I think that we have some connections down there that if we could make it down to Mexico and do some interviews down there as well, I mean, that would just be absolutely fabulous. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the sky's the limit in terms of what we have some potential. Right now, I'm going to get a little time away from it. But I think that once we, start kicking back in, there is a lot that we can do.
Well, I remember I had a story from a guy who was a seminarian back in the day. I don't think he didn't get ordained or anything, but he was also a seminarian down in Mexico. And I remember a story about how the state came in, or I think it was the state, somebody, I don't remember the story in detail, but somebody wanted to come take over the church. And these seminarians and the people, you know, the parishioners stood outside the church with baseball bats and literally didn't let anyone in, like defended it with their lives. I remember the seminarian telling me how he had these, whoever it was, pulling him by the feet while the other parishioners are holding him by the arms, keeping him from being pulled away. Incredible stories. And I'm sure that's just one of them. I don't know where that was. I was told the story about 15 years ago, but amazing stuff. And that's stuff that I think that would be amazing to tell. Exactly. And that's the incredible thing. What is the story of, you know, this group in Europe? I mean, most people just don't know. And to me, I think it would be great to understand better, why did the nine leave Archbishop Lefebvre? Who did they become?
Right.
It's what we want to tell. We want to give the best description we can of why we are where we are, why we are who we are, and why we are the church. And I think that's
right. It's incredibly three-dimensional. It's just it's a wonderfully three-dimensional story that shows God's providence and God's grace and God's protection of his church through the whole thing.
Absolutely. Well, so again, please go watch that. If you're listening to this, go watch that. That is, of course, on Catholic Family Podcast, Indefectible Part 4. And then go to Patreon or PayPal and support us. That would be great. We would greatly appreciate it and would do a lot with it. Now, Dad, we want to get started. I think the first one, this one just blows me away. And it shouldn't, because by now Bergoglio should kind of understand what's coming. But he came out the other day and said that we need a less masculine church. I'm trying to pull it up right now. It says, so this is according to ncronline.org. I think that's National Catholic Review, I think. Asking pardon for speaking plainly, Pope Francis told members of the International Theological Commission that, quote, one of the great sins we have had is masculinizing the church, unquote, which also can be seen by the fact that only 5 of the commission members are women. Now, Dad, I just want to get your first impressions. What would you say? Would you say that the Novus Ordo Church is too masculine?
No. And I think that all you got to do is look back to, you know, our Lord himself chose 12 apostles, all men, you know, and I think that it's one of the things that I think is the undercurrent to what they're doing here. And you see it with the decanonization of saints. You see it with changing doctrine. You see it with all the nonsense that goes on there. Basically, what Bergoglio and all the way back to John 23rd, all of these modernist popes have more or less done is said that, you know what, 2,000 years of history, they're all wrong. They got it wrong. You know, Saint Philomena wasn't actually a saint. Saint Nicholas wasn't actually a saint. We shouldn't have had just men as our apostles. So they've kind of created this brand new reality based on the good feelings of modernism, and it's more and more patently absurd as it goes.
Well, and I think, as you say, the apostles were all men, but I mean, if you think about it too, I mean, Our Lady, who is the most blessed of all creatures ever, who is the most beloved by Christ, by God, of all creatures ever created in the history of the world, she was not an apostle. She was not given a ministry. She was not made a priest. I mean, this is she is the most beloved, and she was still not given this. And that has to be an example of, okay, this is meant to be for you know, to be done by men, as Christ was himself. And I think that's, and again, as you say, it becomes an absolute joke, really. I mean, so my question is this: does he say these types of things because there are no longer any men left in the Novus Ordo, and he can only curry favor with women?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I mean, it's part, you know, I think it was our Blessed Mother at Fatima said that the final battle would be over the family. Mm-hmm. And I think what we've seen is the, you know, demasculization of men and the defeminization of women. And I think you look at the history of the church, and I mean, women do have a remarkable role. I mean, our Blessed Mother, of course, is the first one to look at. She's the most exalted of all creatures. And so, I mean, we have her example that we can always look to. But also, I remember watching something from Archbishop Sheen about, I think it was Good Friday. And he said, did you ever notice on Good Friday that with the exception of St. John, every man failed our Lord during the Passion? Every woman that's documented succeeded. They're at the foot of the cross. You had Claudia, the wife of Pontius Pilate, who basically succeeded. And so, you know, the women have had a special role in the church. St. Catherine of Siena, St. Joan of Arc, I mean, at other times are our leaders. But I think the fundamental fact of the matter is that on a day-to-day basis, it should be the men running the church. Men just have a you know, more political nature about us. I think we have more of a leadership, more of a protective instinct towards society. Women, I think, have more of a protective instinct at a micro level towards their children. And so, yeah, I think that we're mixing all of that up and trying to homogenize men and women, and it's to our absolute societal detriment.
Well, and as we just published recently, the encyclical Castitas Conubii from Pope Pius XI, you see also that men are the authority in society and right. in the home. And I think that's another thing that is absolute fundamental Catholic teaching. And we still get comments on these videos, even encyclicals, which come from the church, are you know, they're still like, oh, this is just too harsh and it's too mean to women. It's like, no, it's not. This is the reality that until 50 years ago, everybody accepted. And women are not lesser. Of course not. They're actually in many ways more. But in the terms of authority, it is always down to the men, and it has been for 2,000 years. And I think that's the thing is, as we see, Bergoglio is doing his best to try to turn that on its head, as he does everything else, right? He's trying to do everything he can do. Well, I mean, look at Amoris Laetitia. You know, I mean, if you look at that's a great example of how he's trying to change Catholicism. And again, if you listen to Cassius Conubii and how it talks about marriage and how it says, you know, you may not ever remarry, you may never, you know, separate and divorce and then, you know, be with someone else pretty much. And it's very clear. It's absolutely doctrine. And then Amoris Laetitia comes and says, well, it depends, actually. You know, we don't know your situation. It depends what your situation is. So pretty much sin is subjective. Now, everyone think about that. I mean, I dare anyone right now who is questioning, you know, the Novus Ordo, go and read a truly Catholic encyclical, let's say Castitas Conubii, and then go and read Amoris Laetitia and tell me what you find out afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to kind of speculate on why Francis does these things. And I mean, we can't really know his interior disposition, except, you know, that it certainly comes off that he's just bent on destruction. I mean, you know, he's got narcissistic tendencies. He wants to say, look at me. And I think that's probably kind of at the core of things is, hey, I'm the Pope. I'm bigger than the church. I'm bigger than, you know, all the teachings of 2,000 years, and whatever I say goes. And we had a comment a couple weeks ago from somebody in the a really fascinating comment. I think we left it up, even though it really was not one that I would have agreed with. But there was somebody in there who was kind of sort of exploring instead of a contest, and I think that they had gotten as far as rejecting recognize and resist, and realizing that you cannot treat your Pope the way the recognize and resistors do. But basically, they were quoting this person was quoting a theologian in the, if you want to call it that, in the Novus Ordo, who was basically saying, you know what, whatever Francis says, that is Catholicism. That's it. That's Catholicism. And I mean, to a certain extent, that's not far off of the truth. That if he were Catholic, you know, it's true. But I think that Francis being as far out in the weeds, he's literally like leading souls into hell. But they're also able to, as a church, use the role of the Pope, use the traditional teachings on the Pope, use the divine institution of it against us, mm-hmm. in order to keep people on board with this, you know, with this wickedness. And leading people astray.
Well, and you see how he twists these things. I mean, here's more of the quote from ncronline.org. This is from Bergoglio. Quote, "The church is woman. And if we do not understand who women are, what the theology of a woman is, we will never understand what the church is." And he continues, "You can debate this, but the two principles are... There are, I should say, it is more important to have the Marian dimension than the Petrine, because the church is the bride of Christ." So it's just, I mean, so he takes these quotes, which you know, the church being the bride of Christ, of course, and then he turns it into, so Dad, tell me what you think when he says, "And if we do not understand who women are, what the theology of a woman is," what on earth is he talking about?
What is a theology of a woman? Yeah, exactly. I mean, the theology of your mom, we did a little, you know, piece obviously in Infectable, where she talked about groups forming in the 90s, and and how they didn't talk theology. That wasn't their job. They talked about raising children. Well, guess right. what? The theology of women is, you know, it is raising children, and it's an extremely sacred the theology is a terrible word for it, but you know, it's extremely sacred what they do. And in a way, I mean, in a way, it's actually more important that they are, they have the divine calling to create a new human being and make that new human being something productive and moral and good, and you know, born with original sin, but with the capacity for good and to bring out that good. I mean, that's incredibly important. And for us men, for the most part, you know, especially those of us who are out in the world, we're basically just supporting that, right? We're out there making a paycheck, doing the mundane things of making a paycheck and keeping the house in order and things like that, so that mom can do the sacred work of raising children, raising a family. And, you know, of course, then we come in as authority, it works perfectly together. We come in as the authority figures. We make the biggest decisions. We, you know, meet out some of the punishments, all that. So, I mean, men and women working together. But yeah, to say something like theology of womanhood, what is that? Yeah, I agree. What does that even mean?
It's word salad. I mean, it's typical of Bergoglio. It's funny. I just see now reading the rest of this article, it's kind of a little bit further on. He says, quote, "I talked too much and it hurt," unquote. Well, my question is for Bergoglio, who did it hurt? I mean, I can tell you, I mean, it's not just you, Bergoglio, who it hurt. I mean, it's just, in a way, it's pandering. It's absolute pandering. Yeah. It's absolute, you know, it's trying to, I don't know, be this, you know, really wise person that he's just not. I mean, he has his own agendas, and he is very, very devious and smart in his own way, but give me a break. He just says things, and eventually, you know, and I think he ended, let me see. He ended, this is pretty interesting. So I think he ended this. It looks like, at least according to this article, he ended, quote, "At Nicaea, faith was professed in Jesus, the only begotten Son of the Father. He became man for us and for our salvation. And it's God from God, light from light. The light that illuminates existence with the love of the Father," unquote. And it's like, well, okay, yeah, that sounds Catholic. You know, it's like, yeah, so, right. so that's what he does though. So he will go and you'll say, what's the theology of a, we need to believe in the theology of a woman. And it's like, okay, head scratch. Oh, but then he ends on something very, very good and very Catholic and doctrinal. So, I mean, come on, he's fine. It's fine. It's like, no, it's not fine. You can't be the Pope and have word salad where people like, you know, Taylor Marshall or whoever else is having to interpret this, what it means, and trying to say, oh no, actually this is what the Pope means. That's not how it works. It's so silly that I really hope people are watching this and saying, wait, what? The theology of a woman? That doesn't sound Catholic to me.
No. I'm really hoping, Kevin, that and this is going to be a topic for another day, I'm sure, but I'm really hopeful that basically the Novus Ordo and this full blooming of modernism in the Catholic, or what looks like appears to be the Catholic Church, is kind of a boomer, you know, phenomenon, and we're going to have to suffer through it. You look at the churches now, the Novus Ordo churches, and he's seen basically everybody in there is a aging boomer. And there's not next to nobody left. And these younger generations, I think, are going to shake themselves and hopefully, God willing, come back to tradition, come back to common sense. And, you know, obviously, until then, we're going to have to suffer this for as long as this current generation is still in power. But, you know, God willing, we'll start to turn things around and have a better future.
Absolutely. Well, in talking about a better future, Dad, we want to move into our second topic, which is pretty interesting. And again, I crossed this on Facebook, and it's from Dave Ramsey, who's a pretty famous, I think he's been around for years, decades now, talking about financial issues, and people call in pretty much saying what their trouble is. And I came across this just scrolling through Facebook, I suppose, and it was a couple. And so the girl is 29, her husband is 32, and she calls in and she says, hey, you know, we need help. We're almost $1 million in debt. $1 million in debt. She's 29. They had, I think, I forget, I didn't write down the numbers. I probably should have, but it was something like 200,000 in student loans, 300,000 on a house, and then something like 300,000 in credit card and personal loans, they say. So it's just wild. And Dave Ramsey too is kind of like kind of floored. Like, wait, you have what? You know, it's like, are you serious? Yeah. And he gives them pretty good advice. Like, pretty much, okay, you have to change your entire life. You have to go and you know, have a really hard, you know, next 3, 5, 10 years and dig out of this and change your entire mindset, change your view of life, change your view on God, et cetera. And I thought it was pretty solid advice from a guy who I imagine probably isn't Catholic, but, you know, pretty solid. But I mean, I guess the thing I wanted to talk about, Dad, is, you know, debt in general. And I know we're not going to dig too deeply into this, though that is a really good topic for the future. But I mean, I guess we talked about this a little bit before the show. What do you think, how does this happen? How does someone, a married couple who are barely 30 years old, how on earth do they get $1 million in debt? Now let's talk first of all economically, and then we'll talk societally, I suppose, or personally.
Well, yeah, right. Well, I think there's a couple things at play here. Number one is especially this younger generation, they don't learn delayed gratification, and so they want everything. They want everything now. And you hear the old test that people that psychologists will give young children. It's supposed to be predictive of their future. You put them in a room with one marshmallow, and you tell them, okay, I'm going to go leave the room. And when I come back, if you haven't eaten the marshmallow, I'm going to give you another marshmallow. You can have two marshmallows. And that you know, whether the children can pass or fail that test, I think is a good. Indicator of you know their self-control and their self-discipline, and I think we are raising a generation of children to a large degree like these, who are, they're just going to eat the marshmallow. They have no sense of, I can give something up today and I can have a better future. And I think you combine that with the fact that in your public schools especially, we're teaching these children algebra. We're teaching them geometry, trigonometry. I mean, sometimes even they get up to calculus and they're learning all this advanced math. They're not learning compound interest and how your life is going to be governed one way or the other by compound interest. Either you're going to be on the debt side and you're always going to be chasing and paying off interest to somebody else, or you're going to be on the plus side and you're going to be earning interest, and you're going to be, you know, living more comfortably, but, you know, slower and over a longer term. And I think that children just, they don't understand that concept whatsoever. So it's like, hey, I see the world, I see these commercials, I see the TVs, and I see the, you know, the ATVs and the big vacations and everything. I got to have it all now. And there's just no thought about how it's going to, you know, come back on them tomorrow.
And so, I mean, I guess then, is that, whose fault is that? I talk to Ina, my wife, all the time, and we talk about, you know, these types of issues and the philosophy of the world and stuff. We like to, we don't have a TV generally, so we tend to talk, you know, philosophically or what we think is philosophically. And I guess, mm-hmm. You know, the question becomes why? And I guess I tend to come back to, yeah, I mean, education, I mean, being kind of the primary thing, and why I think that, you know, America in many ways is actually more communist than other countries. You know, they don't, because they, I guess economically they're not as communistic, they're more capitalistic, but societally, I think they're actually quite communistic, especially in terms of education, where I think they really got their hooks in deep in what they teach and how they teach. And I think that's a sore topic, but, and I could be wrong, but that's kind of what I think, because the question again becomes, if this is what kids are growing up to believe, why? Why is that? And is it because their parents are ill-equipped to teach them or to you know, educate them? Or is it because, you know, they just give everything to the schools, you know, to the state, and the state is purposely leading them astray? Or is the state just bad at what they're doing? I don't know. I mean, I guess that's kind of the question. Yeah. Why are they so badly educated?
Well, yeah, and I think that to a large degree. I mean, I spent a lot of years working in the public school, not a lot in a classroom setting, but enough to know some of these teachers. And basically, I think it's just like the medical industry. It's like the, you know, the political industry, the legal industry. the media industry, all these different industries, you've got some pure unadulterated evil at the very, very, very top, and they are setting an agenda that is meant for enslavement, for basically miseducating children, teaching them a wrong history, wrong economics, wrong everything. And then as you get down a little bit, you're not so top leadership. I think these are basically, idiots for the most part, who are just carrying out, they've worked their way up politically, they're carrying out the desires of this top layer of evil. And then you get down into the trenches, and what happens is you get a combination, you get some good people, you get some really good folks, but their hands are tied in terms of what they can teach. They go out and try to teach real history. They try to teach Christian history. They try to put a good spin on the Middle Ages even, and they're going to get run out of the system. And then what you're left with is basically, sycophants, if you will, that are going to teach what the upper folks, tell them to teach, which is miseducating children. So the whole thing is just completely messed up. Novus Ordo seminaries are exactly the same thing. Listen to the story of Father Oswald and his days in the Novus Ordo seminary. And he'll tell you it's basically exactly the same thing. I think that's a hallmark of the world. It's not just America. I mean, America in some ways is worse, but in a lot of ways is better than the rest of the world. At least we're fighting it. But I think that almost every major substructure of our system is just controlled from the top by these evil, these evil doctrines, evil forces.
Well, and I think that the issue in America is that I think that the communistic values of education, I think, have really taken over, though. I think, again, not necessarily politically or economically, because the American people are more aware to it. It's really an interesting thing that I think, it's a mixed bag, I suppose, of issues. But I think it's interesting too, when you look at, I don't know if anyone here, I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of Bella Dodd, and she, believe what you want. It's not necessarily that she was right, but a lot of what she said about the communist infiltration, I think, makes sense and seems to have come true. And I think that, again, you see that they understood that, in order to quote unquote take over the world, their group of people needed to control the education, the youth, the young people, and the church. They needed to infiltrate the seminaries, and they needed to infiltrate the school systems in order to educate the children. And I think we're seeing that now. And I think another point I think is very interesting, that if you go into the entire idea of usury, and it's a complicated topic, which actually I think I'm going to cover with Father McKenna here in the near future, because it was at one time forbidden by the church, and then the church kind of changed a little bit because the economic systems changed as well. So people make it look like it's just a simple thing that, the church just softens. Yeah. Well, no, that's not necessarily it. I mean, the whole world changed. So the church literally did have to change a little bit of its how it viewed it. But, the usury and the idea of charging a huge interest on a loan is at least questionable. I mean, but then the next question becomes, if you're a 30-year-old, let's say you're 24 or 22 or 20, whatever, you're starting your education, you're still the one who's taking this loan. You're the one who's saying, okay, I am allowing this loan to be taken for me, which is going to end up being $200,000. And that is eventually on you. Now, maybe the one giving the loan is usurious, and maybe that is sinful, but you're still accepting it. You don't have to go to school.
Right, right. Well, and I think that, there was a priest, I forget who the priest was, that said that usury is actually the single most complex theological area of discussion that you can take on. It's extremely complicated. But I do think, I mean, you think about it. Okay, so I'm 18 years old. I want to strike out in the world, and I don't have a job. Okay, how am I going to get a job? I mean, how am I going to get to my job? I don't even have money for bus fare. I got to buy a car. How am I going to buy a car with no money? Well, I'm going to need to take out some debt, take out a loan, and now I go get my, minimum wage job, and I start paying off my car. Where am I going to live? Am I going to live with my parents, or am I going to live in, a place where I have to rent, and rent is basically more or less the same thing. And so, I mean, to a certain extent, or large extent, our system is you know, basically rigged against us to force us into this debt slavery. Now, I think that, to, like you're saying, Kevin, I mean, to get $1 million in debt means that you live way above your means. So, I mean, there's definitely some culpability there. But I know that, you know, I'm a big believer that our system, our very system is corrupt to the core. What we did, and this goes back to 1913, we gave this Federal Reserve, we gave international bankers, and they're incredibly, astoundingly, mind-numbingly rich. And basically what we did is we gave them the ability to create money from thin air, okay? So I go out and you know, I might be working through a bank, but fundamentally speaking, I want to go spend $500,000 on a house, and I go to a bank, and the bank gives me money. Well, at some point in this chain, they just created, the Federal Reserve just creates it out of thin air, and then they give it to the bank, and they want interest paid in return. So they want the money back plus interest. And then in addition to that, they print money, they give it to our government so that our, you know, our wicked government can live beyond its means and spend debt and money. And then basically in order to pay back that money that they created out of thin air, we have to pay taxes to them. So not only are we paying interest on our loans, we're paying taxes. All of this is going back to these bank, international bankers who are getting just, I mean, you can't even fathom how wealthy they are in the trillions of dollars. And, you know, I think that is at the very basis. And of course, then you add immorality and modernism and the Novus Ordo Church and all the, you know, this breakdown of the human, basically human morality. And all of this adds up to this abject debt slavery that it basically runs our world now.
And I totally agree. I think that's absolutely fascinating and absolutely right. That, I mean, that maybe the biggest problem in the world, of course, not talking spiritually or morally, is the banking system. And I think that is something that you know, again, you can talk about and people will nod and agree. Yep, you're absolutely right. I bet you. Even your liberals would hear that and be like, yep, that's so true. Yeah. But nothing actually ever happens. But it's also interesting because I think, though, it is also, there's something also culturally about it, because Germany, as far as I can see, maybe I could be totally wrong about this, but I think there is a less of a debt problem. And part of it is because, you know, education is free. It's not free, but it's certainly cheaper. I mean, in many cases it is free. So there goes a lot of your debt. And people have a better, I don't know, instinct of staying, you know, that living with their relatives or, you know, not going above their means, that there is just a more mature mindset in terms of debt. And I think that is a problem worldwide. But to me, it seems like it is a particularly American thing. But part of it, a huge part of it, is because of education costing just so crazy much. And if you, and I mean, also the crazy thing in America, I mean, you have a baby, you have a family, young family, you go to have a baby. Well, there's 10,000, you know, I mean, what are you supposed to do about that?
Yeah, no, I had a little health scare, a few weeks ago and a month or two ago, and ended up in the hospital just overnight. I mean, just basically observation. I think they did an MRI and, you know, I was in overnight, got released the next day, and it was pretty much a non-event, but now those bills are rolling in, and I think even though I have insurance, I'm going to be out something like $6,000 out of pocket, and that's in addition to probably $10,000 or $20,000 that the insurance is covering, just because I was in the hospital one night overnight, you know, and so yeah, I mean that's a big part of it, but you know. Kevin, I think you can get into the mindset of insurance. So I think there's a mindset of what you might call pooled risk. Okay, that we say, instead of in former days, if I live in a house and my house burned down, all right, you've got a church group, you've got family, you've got a community, you got people who are going to come in. They're going to, you know, they'll probably donate some supplies. You'll get some supplies and you'll rebuild your house. Now, when your neighbor's house burns down, guess what? You're going to spend a couple Saturdays and you're going to be part of a barn raising. You're going to go help them to put their house back together. Well, what we've done in society, and I think it's bad everywhere, but we've basically pooled that risk and we said, okay, well, instead of working with my neighbor, instead of working with my church group or whatever to make sure that my house is ensured can be rebuilt if it's burned down or whatever, then we've put that off onto companies, or we put it off onto the government, and basically we've pooled our risk with them, and they say, okay, yeah, sure, you give me half of your paycheck and we'll take care of your health care, we'll take care of your education, we'll take care of this and that. I personally, I'm not really in favor of it, but I think that model is actually heavier in European countries, in places like Germany, than it is in America. But you know, I suppose for you guys it works.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't know. It's certainly not like everything works over here. Absolutely not. Yeah. Taxes are extreme, but I mean, it's an interesting point when you say that, you know, you rely on the state and stuff. And I had experience like that in the U.S. and I didn't, but someone I knew did. Someone who went to our church, and they said that they had terrible flooding. I think it was flooding or tornado. I think it was flooding, and it really, really bad, and it flooded there. No, it was fire. I don't even remember. Fire, flood, something really tragic happened to their farm. They had a big farm in somewhere in northwestern Colorado, and so they had a, you know, kind of a catastrophe, and so of course, you know, they had paid, you know, farmers insurance or whatever. And so you would expect, you know, when you have a catastrophe that FEMA would come in or the government would come in and help you. And so they waited, you know, for that, you know, so it happened. And of course, the government didn't do anything. And actually, having talked to these people, it's exactly as you said. What actually happened was their neighbors came in and literally just brought over bales of hay and took their horses into their own barns, or, you know, yada, yada, yada. And it was actually the kindness of their neighbor that actually saved them, that kept them afloat, while the government, if I remember right, didn't show up for weeks. And it was because the government was doing everything they possibly could to get out of paying anything for it, because they have no personal desire. They don't care. They don't care about you. I think this is one of the greatest errors. I mean, I know people here in Germany, especially, who just think, you know, of course the government will take care of us. They care about us. What? Where does that come from? I mean, based on what? Based on what evidence does the government ever care about us?
Oh, yeah. No, I can probably give you a similar story, but I think perhaps even more fascinating. I was working in a school district as in technology, kind of a technology lead. And this was 2008. This was right about the time of the great financial crisis. And Barack Obama gets into office and he gets this stimulus package. It's $1 trillion or something like that. Just unfathomable amounts of money. And of course, it's supposed to go to all these different social, you know, roads and bridges. And a big chunk of it was for public school technology. So we're waiting and kind of projecting out and thinking, you know, we're going to probably, as a school district, we're going to get $3 or $4 million out of this stimulus package. And, you know, we're waiting around. And within a couple months, it's, you know, I started asking around, hey, when do we get our money from the stimulus package? And it kind of starts coming down. Well, we're actually not. And really, as it turns out, what happened, the stimulus package, Barack Obama, he gets into office, he gives $1 trillion passed as a stimulus package. He takes it and he gives it all to all of his cronies. It was just political payoffs. That's all it was, political payoffs. And so if you were actually out there waiting for that, because you were on the target list of who was supposed to get the money, we were, because, I mean, what better feel good place can you put it than public school technology? But we never got a dime, and it was because it was all basically to the grifters. It was grift and political payoffs. And so that's another piece of it, I think, especially, I mean, and I'll blame both parties, but the Democrats are far worse than the Republicans in our country, although they're both terrible. But I think that's a big part of it, too. When you give them money, they're going to spend it on their own purposes, their own power base, their own friends. They're not going to spend it for the best of society. And so, yeah, it's another one of those things where that's another root of the problems we have today.
Yeah, they're going to spend it on why lesbians are overweight. I mean, that's not even kidding. I mean,
yeah,
I think it was actually something like there was something like 10 million for Sweden to, I think it was Sweden or Norway or someone, like they sent this money to another country to do a research on why lesbians are fat. It's just like you can't even make this stuff up. So in the end, I mean, it really does come down to it. And I think this is a really good lesson that, I mean, if we really do think that stuff is going to hit the fan, which I think eventually it kind of has to. I mean, Germany for sure. I think actually Germany, I'm propping up Germany, but I think Germany is going to crash certainly faster than America because our system, our Germany system, is built to fail right now. And I mean, when it crashes, you know, what are you going to do? And I think that's a really good lesson because I think that the actual practical thing is you certainly better know your neighbor and like your neighbor, and they better like you and they better trust you, especially, okay, I'm out in the boonies, but even in the city, you know, I mean, you really have to get along because you want it to be that you go to your neighbor and say, Hey buddy, you know, I've got a couple cans of pears. Can I have some milk? Or can I milk your cow for a can of pears? I mean, this is something that I don't know if we're going to cross that in our lifetime. Maybe not. But if we do, you certainly better not be depending on your government to save you. Because if there's anything we've learned, they will not because they don't care about us. And I think eventually that's whenever we talk about politics, no matter who it is, you know, Trump, Biden, Merkel, Stoltz, you know, or Schultz, whatever, you know, the primary care of a government official or, you know, the king or the queen or president should be the care of their citizens. And we don't have that at all. Nobody has that. I don't think there's a country in the world. I mean, maybe Argentina, perhaps.
Right.
Maybe a little crazy, but maybe he cares about that. But I mean, if you don't put Christ, if you don't have the morality of the church and the morality of God and the morality of common sense, I suppose, or you know, of the natural law, then they're just going to do it for themselves, always, every time.
Yeah, and I think we're I like to believe that we're heading towards an up cycle. As far as I think we've fallen morally so far, so fast, so universally that we're due for a bounce back, and I think you see it out there. You see populist type movements that are taking root and gaining momentum, and you see people starting to mock the wokeness. We're not tolerating it anymore. We're starting to mock it, which is what it needs, what it deserves. But I think that my concern is, even though I think we are in an upswing, the momentum for us is positive right now, societally, I do think that the bigger problem is that we're relying on the natural law because we don't have a healthy functioning Pope and a healthy functioning church right now. You know, ineffectual aside, we don't have a healthy church behind us to help keep the devil at bay. And so if we're just relying on natural law, which I think is kind of intertwined with this Malay in Argentina, and you got a really good, I forget the lady's name, Berlusconi in Italy. You've got Trump here in America. These are basically movements that are based on natural law type of morale, you know, moral comebacks. And I think that once we get through that, the devil's going to figure out a way. If the church is not recovered in that time and God doesn't basically give us a pope again, the devil's going to figure out a way to let that crest and then, I think, arc back down again towards the Antichrist end time, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think exactly. I think libertarianism, populism is just another edge of the sort of liberalism. I think that that's, you know, there's a reason why libertarianism and liberalism sound similar, because it is the freedom to do, right? I mean, that's, right. I think that's, you know, it's different. And I understand that. I think it is a step up. If put a gun to my head, I'd pick libertarian over liberal. But right. Libertarian also is just saying that the individual has the right. It's like, okay, the right from whom? From himself?
Right.
From the state? Of course not. This is absolutely, you know, ridiculous. He has a right from God to do what is right.
Exactly. Right. And you know where that comes from? I'm convinced of this more and more. That if there's a speech, I don't think it's a sermon, I think it's actually a speech that Father Benedict from Idaho gave a number of years ago about the worst, about the seven, I think it was, heresies, errors that were built into the Vatican II documents. And he says it's really fascinating, because he says in that speech, he says that the biggest one, the queen mother of all of the heresies, was the notion that man has the right to worship God as he pleases, right? Because that was kind of a thing that John the 23rd really believed in, and got built into the Vatican II documents. But what that did is it set the tone. It redefined what a right was. It was no longer something that was God-given, that we had the ability to do in order to save our souls and for the greater honor and glory of God. But a right became a license. And you think about this, once if by 1965 you had the Vatican saying that man has the right to worship God however he pleases, what happened in 1973 or by the early 70s? Women had the right to abortion. Right. So basically, by redefining the notion of a right, that was part of what just sent us off the moral cliff.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it comes down to so much of humanism. You know, I mean, it all goes back to that whole idea of putting ourselves before God. You know, we can choose, we can decide, you know, we don't need, you know, an almighty, you know, we don't need the church to tell us what is right and what is wrong. And I mean, it's easy for us now to say, you know, that, but as we've seen, the society, that's where it's gone. It's, I mean, you can look since Luther, certainly since the French Revolution, and very certainly since the 1960s. And when you have the quote unquote Catholic Church preaching doctrines of humanism, doctrines of Luther, doctrines of the French Revolution, well, what do you expect? Of course, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. But again, it's not all that bad. I think you're right, Dad. I think there is hope. And I think that because Bergoglio goes so crazy, because society is so nuts and you have so much usury, you have so much slavery, you have so much upfront evil, I think people are starting to see it. I agree with you. I think people are starting to see, okay, something is desperately wrong with what we're doing. And I think that the start, yeah, okay, it's populism, it's libertarianism, but we can certainly pray that people see that's only the start. You know, that of course the end is the actual reign of Christ the King, and it's actually, you know, following the truths of the Catholic Church and of Christ. And I think that what more can we pray for? And I think that's what we need to really aim for and pray for, and not be so depressed. Because yeah, the world is a mess. It is a mess, but there is hope, because we do have God and Christ in the ultimate end, where we absolutely know that we will triumph. Truth will triumph. And that's a positive thought.
Yeah. And as to the extent that we can be working to enslave ourselves, I mean, here we are talking about debt slavery, but I mean, the true, if we can enslave ourselves to our Lord's Sacred Heart, to our Blessed Mother's Immaculate Heart, to God and his angels and his saints, and to the church, and that kind of, you know, that's legitimate slavery, which is truly empowering and is truly freeing. It's counterintuitive, but at the same time, I think what we've done is we've given up the true virtuous holy slavery, and thought that we are free, breaking free from chains, but the reality is we just enslaved ourselves to the devil, and that's kind of where society is now.
Absolutely, and it kind of goes back again also to the wife, right? I mean, I guess we got to kind of wrap this up, but it's true. I mean, because I think, you know, they say, oh, you know, I'm not going to be a slave to my husband. But it's, again, you go back to the encyclical of Pius XI. That's like, well, if you say I'm not going to be subject to my husband, then you absolutely will become subject to the world. And that's what right. It is. You'll become subject to your boss and to your work and to society. And it's much, much worse because it's not how Christ created things. It's not how we are meant to live. And I think that's again, if there's anything we can end on, please go and read the documents of the church. Go listen to, we just recorded the Cassie Canubi. It's a very, very excellent encyclical that it's amazing when we actually had true popes, they actually taught us how to live. I know it's amazing.
Right.
You know, there wasn't a pope saying, hey, you know, the theology of a woman. It was a pope saying, hey, this is what is right and this is what is wrong, because that is what the Pope should be here for. Anyway, Dad, we've gone kind of long here. It's been great. I've really appreciated it. Really, really interesting discussions covering the masculinity of the church and debt right. and society. I think we've planned on this for a long time to talk more about debt and capitalism and stuff with you, me, and Eric. We'll definitely have to get on that sometime here soon. And everyone can stay right. tuned for that. Maybe now that you're a little less busy with Indefectible, which again, everyone.
Indefectible, yeah, we're going to put that aside for a little while, yeah.
Absolutely. Go check that out, everybody. Now Dad can do things that are maybe a little more enjoyable, a little less work. and we'll get to that soon. So please, everyone, like, share, subscribe, comment, all of those things. Let us know what you think. Why do you think debt is a problem? Do you think that the Catholic Church, the Novus Ordo Church, is too masculine? I'm really curious. Anyone who goes to the Novus Ordo listening to this podcast, please tell me if you think, really honestly, do you think that the Novus Ordo Church is too masculine? I'd be really curious to hear from you. And Matt, if you're still listening to this, you better be here next week. And everyone better be listening as well. As always, we plan to be back here next Monday. Dad, thank you very much for filling in. It was very interesting, as always. And until next time, God bless you.
God bless. Thanks, Kevin.